Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest National Language Access webinar from the Migration Policy Institute's National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy. My name is Chandati Pandya, and I'm a policy analyst with the center, and I'll be your moderator for the next hour. Today's webinar is a federal update on what the U.S. Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division has been doing in the area of language access. And before I introduce our esteemed speakers, I wanted to give a quick update of the work we have been doing here at MPI to further understanding and share best practices on providing meaningful access to limited English proficient communities. For those of you unfamiliar with MPI, we are an independent, nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank based in Washington, D.C., and we're dedicated to the analysis, development, and evaluation of migration and refugee policies at the local, national, and international levels. Within MPI, the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy serves as a unique crossroads for different stakeholders involved in immigrant integration to come together and discuss the challenges and opportunities presented in the field. Within the center, we have developed an online digital library and resource center for language access called the Language Portal, which is made possible with support from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. And this is a screen showing you the Language Portal. And the field of language access, of course, has come a long way since Executive Order 13166, which we'll hear a little bit about later on today. In the years since the executive order was issued, promising advances in technology, contracting, training, and partnership with community groups have occurred to improve access to public services and programs at the local, state, and federal level. For the last 5 years, the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy has worked to identify and promote these advances and support the development of additional tools and resources to increase access for U.S. residents who are limited English proficient. Chief among our work on language access is our continued commitment to the portal, which is an online resource for language access practitioners seeking practical technical assistance in managing their translation and interpretation programs. We continue to add hundreds of new contracts, protocols, and sample translated materials to the database on the portal, and have also recently included new original resources, including a Practitioner's Corner article on effective requests for proposals and contracts for language services, and on best practices to keep in mind when designing an internal assessment of your language access program. We also recently published an LEP data brief that contains state-level data on the number, share, and linguistic diversity of LEP individuals using the most up-to-date data available from the American Community Survey. We'll continue to update this product as new data becomes available, and we're also planning on publishing county-level data for you all to use. Over the course of MPI's work on language access, we've strived to make such resources available to you all in order to help you manage your day-to-day language access operations. But sometimes it's important to take a step back from the nitty-gritty and understand the broader context under which the provision of language access services is taking place. Under the leadership of Attorney General Eric Holder, the U.S. Department of Justice has been coordinating across the federal government to improve its communications with LEP communities. Since early 2011, there has been a flurry of activity at the federal level as agencies reconsider their language access priorities and develop plans to fulfill their responsibility to provide effective translation and interpretation services to the scores of individuals who require assistance in order to more fully participate in society. At the same time, DOJ continues to move forward in its oversight of language access provision at the state and local level, including in state and local court systems, corrections, and law enforcement. With this renewed commitment, MPI has decided to expand our scope to create products and organize meetings for federal audiences, even as we continue our work at the state and local level. This webinar is the first of many webinars and in-person workshops MPI will be holding that target federal audiences as they enter the fold of language access. In the coming weeks, we will email the federal agency participants on the call with more detailed information about the expanded scope of work to address the issues and unique needs of federal agencies as they recommit themselves to providing better communication with LEP communities. The screen that you're looking at here currently points to the new federal corner space that we've included on the language portal to house the wealth of new events and information that we'll be providing over the coming months. So just quickly to go over the logistics for today, I'll show you how to use the webinar facility that we're participating in. Then we'll hear from the U.S. Department of Justice. And then I'll open up the floor to questions and answers. Finally, I want to say thank you to everyone who submitted questions to DOJ ahead of today's webinar. I've passed your questions on to them, and they've tried to incorporate their responses into their presentation here. Please feel free to email me afterwards if you want further information or clarification. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce our speakers for today. First, we have Emily McCarthy. Emily is the Deputy Chief of the Educational Opportunities Section of the Civil Rights Division within DOJ. During her 11 years in the section, much of her work has focused on ensuring that state and local educational agencies meet their federal obligations to provide equal educational opportunities to English language learners. Next, we have Christine Stoneman, and Christine is a special legal counsel in the Federal Coordination and Compliance Section of the Civil Rights Division of DOJ. She's been a leader in implementing and enforcing the language access provisions of Title VI and Executive Order 13166, and has been instrumental in the development of the DOJ LEP guidance. The creation and continued work of the Federal Interagency Working Group on LEP, DOJ policy, and enforcement related to language access in the courts. Lastly, we have Laureen Lagagaran. Laureen is an attorney advisor at the Federal Coordination and Compliance Section of the Civil Rights Division. She handles discrimination cases, provides technical and legal assistance, offers regulatory policy and program review, and coordinates federal civil rights enforcement. With that, I'd like to turn the floor over to Christine Stoneman. Thank you, Christine.
Thank you, Shaughnessy, and thanks everyone for being on this webinar. It's an exciting opportunity for us in the Civil Rights Division to talk to you all about this really important issue. I want to first start by thanking MPI for the great work that you all have done. The portal, these webinars, the many opportunities you've had, you've brought people together, have been a real resource for the field, and we continually refer to the portal and your work and the support of the NE Casey Foundation as making real progress in the field. So really appreciate that, and thank you, Shaughnessy, also for being the facilitator on this webinar. So I wanted to start by talking a little bit about the Federal Coordination and Compliance Section, which is one of 11 sections within the Civil Rights Division. And Emily is from one of the other sections in the Civil Rights Division that deals with Educational Opportunities Section. But the Federal Coordination and Compliance Section has a number of mandates. We have 8 staff attorneys in our office and a couple of investigators. And we have a very wide mission, wide and broad mission, which began with Executive Order 12250. And Executive Order 12250 is an executive order that was issued by the President a long time ago, requiring that the Civil Rights Division coordinate Title VI and Title IX enforcement throughout the federal government, ensuring consistency in the application and enforcement of those statutes throughout the federal government. And gradually, we also gained the enforcement ability to investigate cases in which a complaint has been brought or a compliance review is being conducted by recipients of Department of Justice funds. We share that enforcement capability with the Office of Justice Programs, Office for Civil Rights. In addition, then, as we'll learn in a minute, Executive Order 13166 gave us the coordination authority over language access efforts by the federal agencies and within our own Department of Justice. And so our office conducts a wide range of investigations, policy work, and technical assistance and regulatory work. Just examples beyond the language access context might provide a little context. We've been working with the Environmental Protection Agency to invigorate environmental justice, enforcement, and policy. And we've been involved with an effort to overturn Sandoval legislatively on the Hill. We run a Title VI working group and an LEP working group with the entire federal government. And we sometimes go on site or conduct investigations or consult with our federal agency counterparts in the civil rights offices across all of the federal government. So aside from language access, we have a lot of other things that we do, but I just wanted to share some of that with you. Today we'll talk about the language access priorities in our office and how we conduct some of that work. So I wanted to start out by, of course, laying a little bit of the legal framework for our work. Of course, the foundation of the language access work at the federal government level is Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And what that law requires, of course, as has been interpreted through the courts and in the regulations, through the regulations, is that federal recipients of federal financial assistance, whether they be hospitals or schools or courts or transportation agencies or emergency providers or what have you, that they need to provide meaningful access to limited English proficient individuals. And so that's the foundation of a lot of our language access work. And then we're going to talk about special issues in education, and we'll talk about our federal enforcement efforts with regard to federally conducted work. And what that means is, because of Executive Order 13166, there's a separate obligation for federal agencies, and federal agencies are not subject to Title VI, but they are subject to the executive order, and there's an obligation for each of the federal agencies to themselves provide meaningful access to limited English proficient people. This is our do-unto-ourselves provision in the executive order, and Laureen's going to talk about that and what we've been doing. There's a lot of exciting news in that area. So we start with Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which says, no person in the United States shall, on the ground of race, color, or national origin, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. So it's no person. It's not no citizen, no lawfully present individual. It's no person in the United States. And that's a really important point to underscore. We continue to underscore that in numerous ways through our enforcement and policy efforts. Of course, the issue of national origin discrimination is where the requirement to provide language access comes. It's the provision that requires that an individual cannot, because of the language they speak or their ancestry, be discriminated against. And in Lowe v. Nichols in 1974, the U.S. Supreme Court underscored that that there's this connection between national origin discrimination and language discrimination, and that failure, that discrimination that on the basis of language can be also national origin discrimination and violates Title VI. The other thing I wanted to point out is that there are assurances and contracts that are signed every time a recipient of federal financial assistance receives federal funds. And throughout those assurances and conditions of receiving federal funds, there's an obligation to ensure that Title VI, that the recipient follows Title VI. And in many instances, through our efforts with our federal agency partners, we've been able to also put in that contractual language, that specific language that says that a recipient of federal funds needs to provide language services consistent with Title VI and the LEP guidance that we've issued. So Lowe v. Nichols was a long time ago, and the Department of Education and the Department of Health and Human Services, which were one agency at the time of Lowe v. Nichols, did a lot of work with regard to ensuring language services. And the EEOA, which Emily will talk about in a minute, really pressed the issue of making sure that ELL students, English language learners, were obtaining appropriate services after Lowe. And I always think of Executive Order 13166, which came about in the summer of 2000, just as I was starting at the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, as the rest of our agencies catching up to Lowe. And so what the executive order said is that each of the federal agencies had to provide, if they didn't already have it, guidance to all of the recipients of federal funds for that agency to make sure that they understood their obligation to provide meaningful access to LEP individuals. Separately, as we discussed, and as Laureen will set forth, the executive order required for the first time that federal agencies themselves provide meaningful access. So, to summarize, federal and federally funded programs must provide meaningful access to programs and benefits for persons with limited English proficiency. So what does all of that mean? Well, I'm going to skip one slide here. Forgive me just a moment. We'll come back to that in a minute. One question that always comes up is, what is your enforcement of those provisions? So I talked a little bit about how our office, the Federal Coordination Compliance Section, shares jurisdiction to investigate complaints of Title VI violations and Safe Streets Act violations with our Office of Justice Programs Office for Civil Rights. So some of the cases, some of the complaints that come into the Department of Justice that are of Title VI violations and language access violations, where those complaints are alleging discrimination by a recipient of DOJ funds, either our office or the Office of Justice Programs, OCR, would have jurisdiction to open that investigation. And some of what happens is that if the complaint comes to our office, we may be more likely to open it than if it comes to OJP. And some of it is based on where our complaints are already being investigated and what types of cases are already being investigated. So at this moment in time, our office has a larger caseload of courts language access cases, for instance, than the Office of Justice Programs Office for Civil Rights. LEP individuals can file a complaint with the federal funding agency or with FCS so that if, for instance, you had a complaint, someone had a complaint against an entity and they didn't know which federal agency to file that complaint with, they didn't know who funded that agency, but it was fairly clear to them that it was likely that there was federal funding, you can file that complaint with the Federal Coordination and Compliance Section. There's also a number of web tools now that allow for you to discover whether or not an entity is receiving federal funds from a particular agency, so you might be able to do that. And we'd be happy to post some of those sites after the webinar and share them with you. But for the most part, if the entity, the federal agency that has jurisdiction over your complaint is the federal entity that provides federal financial assistance to the recipient, and we're happy to help figure out who that is and provide some tools for you to figure that out as well. With regard to DOJ enforcement and DOJ recipients, I did want to share a couple of latest enforcement efforts. Many of you know that the Department of Justice issued a letter of findings against the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office in December of 2011. And the letter of findings did not only discuss language access, of course. First, we found that MCSO engages in a pattern or practice of unconstitutional policing, and specifically that MCSO engages in racial profiling of Latinos and unlawfully stops, detains, and arrests Latinos. Second, we found that MCSO unlawfully retaliates against people who criticize its policies and practices. And third, we found reasonable cause to believe that MCSO operates its jails in a manner that discriminates against Latino inmates that are limited English proficient. We found that MCSO routinely punished Latino inmates that are limited English proficient when they fail to understand commands in English and denies critical services that are provided to other inmates, and that these actions violated Title VI. And that's in a letter of findings that's online, and we can, we did provide the link there. I also just wanted to share with you an update from our Courts Language Access Initiative. Many of you may know that in August of 2010, Assistant Attorney General Tom Perez issued a letter to all state courts reminding them of their Title VI responsibilities to ensure language services and pointing out that a number of state courts seemed to be deficient in complying with Title VI in cases involving, for instance, civil matters and by charging LEP individuals for the cost of interpretation. That letter is also available online on LEP.gov. This letter flowed from a lot of work that we had been doing with the courts, including an agreement that we reached with Maine, the Maine court system, earlier in 2008. The link is also available on your slide. And from technical assistance and a lot of and conversations and investigations that we had been conducting. So this letter was based on a history of working on courts language access issues. Since that time, the Department of Justice has reached an agreement with the Colorado State Court. As part of the agreement, Colorado's Chief Justice issued a comprehensive directive that provides for free and competent interpreter services in all criminal and civil proceedings, as well as court operations. And DOJ recently approved the language access plan that Colorado created, which explains how the court system will implement the rule. DOJ will monitor compliance for the next 2 years. And then in March of this year, we sent a letter of finding in a case in North Carolina. After conducting a Title VI investigation, we found that the people in North Carolina were being harmed in numerous ways by failure to provide language services in courts. The letter provides examples, and we can all look at it and say, you know, it's not okay to not provide an interpreter in a child custody proceeding. To use prosecutors to help interpret on the fly in a proceeding involving criminal actions. These are life-changing examples of what happens when individuals are not provided equal access to state court. And you can find a copy of that letter online as well. Now I'm going to flip back to the slide on education. I'm going to turn it over to my good friend and colleague, Emily McCarthy.
Thank you, Christine, and thank you very much to MPI for having us here and to everybody who's joined the webinar today. We're very appreciative of the opportunity. I just wanted to cover briefly today language access issues that arise in the education context and how the Justice Department Civil Rights Division, particularly our Educational Opportunities Section, address those issues. And in doing so, I'm going to talk about Title VI as well, which we share enforcement for Title VI with the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights. And as Christine explained, the seminal case interpreting Title VI to require meaningful access for students who are not proficient in English was the Lau versus Nichols case in 1974, which essentially the Supreme Court agreed with what was then called HEW, the Department of Housing, Education, and Welfare's 1970 memorandum interpreting the Title VI obligation to mean that recipients of federal funds in the education context had to take affirmative steps to make sure that educational programs were accessible to students who did not speak English and their parents. And in Lau, the Supreme Court agreed with that interpretation and determined that the San Francisco School District was violating Title VI by denying, not providing any services to a good percentage of the students in San Francisco who were Chinese speakers. That case is actually still going on today, and it's one that I'm still working on. That is not the norm, I might add, but we're working collaboratively with San Francisco, and we have a much more recent agreement that provides a lot of effective changes. The populations and districts obviously change over time, and this is one where it certainly has. So in 1974, the same year that the Supreme Court issued this decision, Congress enacted the Equal Educational Opportunities Act of 1974. And there, basically, Congress codified Lau's holding, but did it independent of federal funding. So the EEOA applies to all state and local education agencies that are public, independent of whether they take federal funds. And the language of the EEOA is a little bit different from Lau's language, which is focused on, meaningful access, because the EEOA language says that states and school districts have an obligation to take appropriate action to overcome language barriers that impede equal participation by students who don't speak English in instructional programs. So the question for the courts when the EEOA came down was, what does appropriate action mean? There was almost no legislative history on this issue. And one of the seminal decisions interpreting this requirement was the Castaneda versus Picard decision from the Fifth Circuit, where the court essentially created a three-part test for looking at this question. And those three questions still drive the Department of Justice's EEOA work, as well as OCR's Title VI work. And those three questions are, is the state or the school district, have they adopted an educationally sound program for overcoming language barriers? And if so, have they committed adequate resources to implement that program and theory effectively? And even then, the inquiry is not over, because if after a period of time of providing those resources and attempting to implement that program properly, the evidence doesn't show that students' language barriers are actually being overcome in a reasonable period of time, then the obligation is still not met, and basically either the state or the district has to revise the program to ensure that it is indeed effective at overcoming language barriers and enabling students to access educational programs meaningfully and equally. So the Department of Justice is the primary, holds primary responsibility for enforcing the EEOA. Private individuals also can bring actions under the EEOA, and the Department of Justice can intervene in a private action under the statute. And so, like the Department of Ed's Office for Civil Rights, our EEOA work consists of complaint-driven work, but we don't need a complaint to do the work. We can proactively initiate compliance reviews, similar to OCR, which initiates compliance reviews as well. And at times, we do them together. We do investigations with OCR, and we've done some recently. One has been the Boston, Massachusetts case, where we had just achieved a second comprehensive settlement agreement, and that was a terrific collaboration with OCR, my office, and the Boston Public Schools. When we do an investigation, whether it's complaint-driven or compliance-driven, we basically ask for information, we go on site, we interview folks, we determine whether there are any violations, and if we do, we provide notice, written notice of what they are, and we immediately try to start negotiating with the district to identify steps that, you know, the district itself wants to take to address them, and where needed, we inform those steps as well. The outcome is almost always what we call a settlement agreement, where we have basically reduced to writing the various steps that the district or the state, if that's the case, will take to fulfill its EEOA obligations, or in the case of joint agreements with OCR, it's both its EEOA and Title VI obligations. And then we monitor those agreements, and we do so not only on the basis of reporting, all of our agreements require reporting, but also we go back on site, we consult with complainants if there are some. We do rely very much on the good faith efforts of district staff to implement those remedies. And, you know, when those are not being implemented, either on parents or others who are aware that they're not being implemented, so we take that obligation very seriously. And if we were to have an agreement and it were being violated, both Department of Ed and DOJ would notify them, and we would have the opportunity to sue if needed. Department of Ed could refer to us for suit. We could bring our own suit. Or Department of Ed also has the option of trying to terminate federal funds. But again, very, very rare. And one of the best parts about our work is that it's a very collaborative area, and we've made a lot of progress, and we're really excited about the work. It's a big priority for the division.
Thank you, Emily, for that. I know you have to run shortly, and there were several questions that our webinar participants had regarding education issues and language access, and I wanted to just ask a couple of them quickly. One is that, you know, in order to stay in compliance and not be the subject of an investigation, what should a school district do in terms of resources? What resources can they look to within DOJ as well as Department of Ed, to the extent that you can talk about that?
Right. Obviously, every situation is fact-specific, but there are definitely a number of resources. We have on our website most of our settlement agreements, which will give any district a good idea of the kinds of issues that we have found and the ways that we have remedied them. The Department of Ed has a website where they have their 1970 memorandum, which I mentioned, their 1985 memorandum, another from 1991. There's also LEP.gov, which has a wealth of information about this issue as well. The Department of Ed, as I understand it, also does post some of their agreements and maybe even their letters of findings. So those are all good resources. And then, of course, there's the case law that's out there as well, which we as a department, we look at all of this information when evaluating, and we try to collect as much information as possible to have this full picture.
Great. And just one last question. A lot of the webinar participants have been sort of eager to know if there's discrimination against an LEP child who has disabilities, who would be the appropriate agency to raise a complaint to when the disability issue comes into play with an LEP child?
It could implicate several federal statutes. Certainly under the EEOA, in our compliance reviews, we always look at whether districts are meeting their obligations to take appropriate action, because if a student has a disability, how that district responds in terms of what language support services it provides, what special ed services it provides, are they accessible given that language barrier, what policies are in place to make sure that students who are ELL are not being placed in special education on the basis of their language barriers. When, for example, there are IEP meetings or IEP communications, any sort of special ed, you know, rights and responsibilities, that kind of information is essential, and we do look to make sure that districts are providing LEP parents and LEP students with meaningful access to that information. So again, if you look at our website, I would say most of them have special ed provisions, but the Department of Ed likewise looks at this issue under Title VI, and both Department of Ed and the Department of Justice, we share responsibility for enforcing Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the IDEA, and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. So depending on what the issue is, it could be that there are violations of special ed specific regulations and laws, and there could be violations of Title VI of the EUA. In the language context, there could be both. And we certainly want to make sure that, you know, the child is one person and you can't sort of separate these issues out. But one of the most common issues we find is that communication of special ed vocabulary, which is so specialized, and IEP information is not getting to parents in a language that they understand. And so that has certainly been a focus of both departments.
Great. Thank you, Emily, for your time. I wanted to now turn the floor over to Laureen Michael-Garen.
Sure. Thank you so much, Chandasi, and thank you to MPI. I'm just going to advance our slides. So this afternoon, I thought that my goal, Chandasi referred to a flurry of activity going on behind the scenes within federal agencies, and so I was really hoping to give all of you on the phone a peek into the work going on behind the scenes. And so what is happening? So as Chris pointed to you, the obligations of federal agencies under Executive Order 13166, I wanted to talk about two recent memoranda that the Attorney General sent to first federal agencies, and then actually he sent to the one to Department of Justice components 8 months before he sent the one to federal agencies. And it all goes back to the bottom line point of how do we ensure that federal resources and services are available and accessible to the LAP community? You know, in past presentations, people often ask me, well, why now? Why 12 years later? And I think in part, one of the reasons why the Attorney General issued these two memoranda are in part the GAO found in April 2010 that federal agencies, they have an inconsistent knowledge and compliance with the language access principles embodied in Executive Order 13166. So these tandem memoranda are a way for federal agencies to recommit to Executive Order 13166. And so this afternoon I wanted to talk, if you could think about three different levels. One is the overall federal agency level. Two is the Department of Justice. And then within the Department of Justice, our particular division, the Civil Rights Division. I know that's a lot of bureaucracy for those of you not in Washington, D.C., but I think it's helpful to think of these three different structures to think about the different ways we're approaching ensuring access to LEP individuals on the federal agency side. So I wanted to read a quotation from Attorney General Eric Holder's memoranda to federal agencies, whether in an emergency or in the course of routine business matters, the success of government efforts to effectively communicate with members of the public depends on the widespread and non-discriminatory availability of accurate, timely, and vital information. What I like to point out here is how do we get information now, 12 years later? For me, the first thing that I think of is the internet and our websites as a portal of communication with LEP individuals. So certainly things have changed in the 12 years since the executive order was signed. I wanted to also look at a couple of action items that the Attorney General asked individual federal agencies to do in concert with the memoranda. One is to establish a language access working group. I'll talk about the Department of Justice Language Access Working Group in a minute, but the second is to conduct an inventory of languages most frequently encountered by federal agencies and identify the primary channels of contact with LEP community members. Third, establish a schedule to periodically evaluate and update agency LEP services and LEP policies, plans, and protocols, and submit those updated language access plans to our office, the Federal Coordination and Compliance Section. So at FCS, we have been busy reviewing federal agency plans. So some people have asked, well, what is the standard of review? That's actually very easy for us to answer.
If you go to LEP.gov, there is an assessment and planning tool, which was issued, I think, back in May. And that assessment and planning tool, it's got a checklist, and it is pretty much what we use to assess language access plans. So that's the status of where we are with reviewing and how we review federal language access plans. The memorandum to agencies also asks agencies to ensure that their staff can identify LEP contact situations, notify the public about the availability of language assistance services, and draft recipient guidance. And so I won't read this quote aloud, but this is a quote from the Attorney General to actually the Department of Justice. So I think for those of you who are unfamiliar with the Department of Justice, it's approximately 40 different components ranging from the FBI to the DEA to the Executive Office for Immigration Review, our office, the Civil Rights Division, the Criminal Division. It's a lot of different agencies under the banner of the Department of Justice. And really, for us, our charge is to talk the talk and walk the walk when it comes to Executive Order 13166 and to ensure that our programs and activities are accessible to LEP communities. So I'm not going to dwell too much on this next slide. Because the action items to the Department of Justice are very similar. We have a Department of Justice Language Access Working Group, which has met periodically for the last 18 months. And I'm just going to cut to the most exciting part, which is yesterday, the Attorney General, I'm very pleased to announce that the Attorney General released to the public, if you go to our website, www.justice.gov, the department's language access plan, and I'm actually going to go through some screenshots. Unfortunately, we don't have live internet, and so unfortunately, this slide was created yesterday afternoon, and the actual blog about our language access plans came online just a few hours ago, so you are getting cutting-edge information. Right now, if you go to Open Government, so where the red arrow is pointing, that is one portal where you could access the language access plans. So if you hit the language access plans, you would get to this page. And here it's the availability of language assistance services within the department. You'll see that we have 6 languages up. We are still in the process of adding translations. So there will be other languages that will come online shortly. And then we also have a list of language access plans. As you'll see, there are not 40 components listed, but we are actually in the process. Many of the components, I would say the majority of components, have prepared language access plans, and we are just in the process of working with our IT people so that they don't kill us and posting all of these online for you shortly. So this is the place to check back for other language access plans. And then here's, just quickly, our own Civil Rights Division language access, availability of language access services webpage. We have our own internal Civil Rights Division language access working group, and I invite you to read the Civil Rights Division plan, read the Justice Department's plan, read the other plans, read all of the plans, and I actually really invite you to solicit, to actually provide us with comments to our plans, because although the plans are up, we are by no means done with the work. The plans are overarching principles, but we are in the process of creating procedures, and that is absolutely where we could really use your input in terms of how to best provide access to LEP individuals.
Great, thank you. We just have a couple of minutes left. I wanted to give both Christine, you and Laureen the opportunity just to offer some closing remarks. And for those of you on the call today who've been asking how we'll communicate with you all about the links that Laureen and Christine have been talking about, in a couple of days we'll email you with further information. So if you registered and you're on the call, you'll get a follow-up email from us. So, before I turn it over to you to offer some closing remarks, I just wanted to say thank you for all of this information. I think it's been really helpful, and I hope that the participants on the call will avail themselves of the contact information that we have listed on this webinar and, you know, really reach out to the agency to get more clarification when needed.
Well, thanks, Chanda C. This has been really fun, and we could probably talk about this all week, Lorraine and I. It's one of our favorite topics. But I just wanted to say again, thank you so much on behalf of the Department of Justice to MPI, to Chanda C, and to Casey Foundation, who supports all of this work, and also to the participants on the phone for being so actively engaged. I just want to keep going, really, here. But the Department of Justice clearly in the Civil Rights Division and Tom Perez, our Assistant Attorney General, have highlighted language access as one of the priorities, whether it be in education, in voting, in the courts context, in helping all of our fellow civil rights agencies enforce their laws, whether it be in Maricopa County, whether it be federally conducted activity that the Department of Justice we were just in a meeting yesterday with yesterday with the Assistant Attorney General for Administration and the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, talking about how it's so important to get our own house as accessible as we require of our recipients. And, you know, we've been working on this for a long time, but we're really excited to have been able to roll this out here today with MPI. So thank you so very much.
You're welcome. All right. Well, that concludes the webinar for today. Thank you again for your participation, and I encourage you to visit www.migrationpolicy.org/languageportal, as well as lep.gov for more information. Thanks. Bye.